Hey folks, and tonight's episode is brought to you by YesPleaseVintage.com. If you're in the States and a fan of vintage and upcycled housewares and clothing, give YesPleaseVintage.com a check for clothing, jewelry, homeware, and some really awesome finds. So go check them out now at YesPleaseVintage.com. And currently, if you spend over $60, you get free shipping on all orders. Hello and welcome to the Asian Cinema Film Club. I'm your host as always, Edward Jones, and joining me, of course, is my co-host, the Professor, Mr. Stephen Palmer.
Hello there, everybody.
This is episode 116, and tonight we're going to be looking at Whispering Corridors, the Korean horror film that came out during the boom of the Tartan Asia Extreme era, and has gone on to spawn many, many sequels, which we will obviously get into as part of tonight's main feature. But before then, it's time to ask what you've been watching. And Stephen, I don't know about yourself, but I've got a few things to talk about because we've had our productions meant that we've been able to stack a lot up since the last episode.
We have, I guess with the World Cinema podcast and our special episode with our book review episode, new police story episode, we've had a few extra weeks. So yeah, I've got a couple of things. Do you want to go first though this week? Just mix it up.
Okay, so we're going to mix it up then. Right, so other than my, you know, my daily watching of the story of Ricky O at the moment, because I'm obviously in 5K training and you need that sort of movie to pump you up. There's no, like, you know, a lot of people like to watch Rocky or Bruce Lee philosophies and stuff. I like to watch the story of Ricky O before I go out and hit that 5K trail. Need to get that focus on to get to Super Saiyan tough. But yeah, I managed to pick up a 72-day trial of Crunchyroll because of Xbox perks. So I hopped right onto that. So I'm back on the trail when it comes to One Piece. So I scratched a few more episodes off on that. But more importantly, it means we can also have Dragon Ball chat. Okay, so since we obviously finished off Dragon Ball Super last time we had Dragon Ball chat, and on Crunchyroll they got the two new movies. They got Dragon Ball Super Broly and Dragon Ball Super Superhero, which is probably one of the more clumsy titles on there. Starting off with Broly. I mean, Broly is a character that's appeared in the original Dragon Ball, and this is a chance to sort of like reformat the character and play around with it some more. And the thing I always love about these Dragon Ball movies is that you can come into them knowing nothing about Dragon Ball, the 200 odd episodes of Super that came before it, or the 200 of Dragon Ball Z, or the 200 of original Dragon Ball that came before it, because they have these wonderful summaries at the start and it brings you up to speed with everything you need to know. And the same with this one. And yeah, it's a very sort of traditional sort of Dragon Ball story. You've got Goku and Vegeta taking on the Super Saiyan known as Broly, who's like basically the Dragon Ball version of Bane. He's just like a really big muscular guy who's a super powered Saiyan at the same time. And yeah, we got a lot of beams, a lot of fun action, a lot of burly men screaming. It does what you want it to do for a Dragon Ball movie, so really enjoyed that. Dragon Ball Superhero, on the other hand, was also a really fun watch, and one that I actually really enjoyed, I think, a bit more than Broly, as this one sees the return of the Red Ribbon Army, who team up with the son of the professor who created the original androids. And he's sort of like, he's really superhero obsessed, so he creates these two new androids known as Gamma 1 and Gamma 2 to basically seek vengeance against Goku and all his buddies, but they're themed after and designed after superheroes. Again, really fun one here, and it's nice to see them mix it up and not just have like Goku and Frieza do all the fighting, as we got to see Piccolo and some of the B players get to have their moment to shine in this one as well. But obviously, if you're not familiar with the Dragon Ball world, just not, I'm going to be reeling all this off to you, and it means absolutely nothing to you. But again, if you're a Dragon Ball fan, you really enjoy this, and the animation is absolutely stunning as well. From there, you okay there, Sim?
Well, I was just going to say, I found something out about Dragon Ball this week that I didn't know.
Yeah.
So obviously, other than some vague association with some old computer games, I've never touched the Dragon Ball thing. However, I'm considering watching Monkey, the Japanese TV show that was very popular in the UK in the late 70s, early 80s, because I've managed to find copies of it, which is basically based on Journey to the West. And I didn't know, but Dragon Ball Z is based on Journey to the West, although I think some of it...
Dragon Ball is more Journey to the West. I mean, the fact that Goku has a monkey's tail, so when he has a full moon, he turns into a giant rampaging monkey that shoots lasers.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's more in tune with Journey to the West than Z is.
Yeah, but I had no idea. So what's Z compared to Dragon Ball?
Is it the next era.
Right.
Because
it's the new generation.
Kind of, because the story is constantly continuing as these characters get older, but Goku gets more stupid. They get more like powerful, but as Goku's intelligence goes greatly downhill as it goes on. So at this point, when you get into Super, Goku is now a grandfather, and then you've got the generations before that all sort of like add to this world.
Right.
But yeah, it starts off with Dragon Ball, and then which is like child Goku, and then you've got like what we should say is like adult Goku, which you get into Z because he has a son. And then you get into Super, which is like the series after, which is when he becomes a grandfather. But at the same time, he's like still just like the sort of grandfather who would totally kick your ass.
I know you love all this, and I know that we've probably got lots of listeners who bloody love all this.
Yeah.
I find it so daunting. I don't think I'd ever start. However, like I said, once I found this out, I'm thinking, maybe. But no, it never will happen. Or I'll get 10 episodes in and give up. But it's, I just, anime serials, on the whole, I just think are just too daunting for me. But I'm very impressed with your ability to see,
my ability just to kill time. What's this? I mean, One Piece is like 1,000-odd episodes. And it's still going. It's this highly acclaimed series. And again, it's another of those. The thing with anime series is that you build up as they go on. It's not just like. And you often find it's a very sort of traditional with the Japanese series that a series will run for a year. And then it'd be all self contained during that year. And then we come back and we pick it up. And normally it'd be like the next generation or we'll sort of continue on these. I think if I was you, though, and just obviously just getting started with these, then I would start with like Dragon Ball Z Battle of the Gods, which is sort of like a condensed version of the first arc of Dragon Ball Super. And then you can go into Resurrection F, which is like the condensed version of the second arc. And both of those have got wonderful recaps, so it would bring you up to speed and like what the Dragon Balls do, you know, you get the 7 Dragon Balls and then you get you can ask the great Dragon God Shinmu for a wish. Normally people just ask for the same thing, but which is normally like they destroy the planet and then they ask the wish to have everything restored to how it was. It also means that you can also watch Dragon Ball Z Kai, which is a condensed version of Dragon Ball Z, because Dragon Ball Z has a lot of filler episodes in it. Like the 7 episodes have been running along like Heaven's Road, and he has a foot race against Satan. And there's a lot of filler episodes because they needed time for the source material to get ahead of them. Yeah. So they created wonderful episodes such as Goku and Vegeta get Goku and Piccolo get their driver's license, which turned out to be the creator Dragon Ball's favorite episode of the series.
I mean, having sort of new series and reimaginings. And I mean, I'm a Transformers fan, right? And
yes.
I have no problem at all in living in the world where there's an American version of a Japanese one, and then some series count and some are alternate and some are resets and some are ignored by the fans. And then I'm quite a fan of the early mainframe animated Beast Wars and things like that. I'm quite happy existing in the world where all these conflicting series exist. I don't have a problem with that. But yeah, I think it's just the daunting nature of how many episodes there are is quite. But if there's like, I don't know, like you described, like
condensed
versions. Yeah, I mean it feels different to. Like when you talk about Gundam and things like that, which are far less episodes, but I think there's like this fandom around them, which I would find absolutely. Is it Gundam or is it? Evangelion. Especially those mech shows. You know, there's this fandom around them, which makes it almost impenetrable to even investigate, you know, and it's hard. And I know I do an Asian Cinema Film Club co-host and I've been doing it for many years, but I'm not ashamed to admit, mate, I find the world of anime really fucking hard.
It's all about just finding the right things. I mean, certainly with things like Gundam, it is confusing because, as I said, no, you try to ask people like the logical order to put them in, and then people just get like give these really convoluted answers where you need to start. And obviously with something like Gundam, you don't have to start right back in the early animation ones. I mean, the original series of Gundam, they've broke down into three movies, which you can find on Netflix, which is Gundam 1 to 3. And then obviously from there, you go into Gundam Wing, which is its own thing. You've got Gundam Seed, which again is its own thing. So you've got these, well, there's many series. So they're kind of like, a lot of them are just their own thing. They're like self-contained stories. But obviously, if you try to talk to some people, they're just like complain. They're like say it's like this big storied historical arc and show you a lot of charts and stuff. But,
And I guess that's why it's popular, because it's appealing to certain mindsets, isn't it?
Gundam, I think, has got that Transformers appeal with the fact that if you're into Gundam, you can do Gunpla, which is where you build the models of Gundam.
Yeah, yeah. I've actually got some of the models. I've known about the models longer than I've known about the animations. My stepfather is a big Airfix modelling, you know, proper painting them and dioramas and shows them off at shows. And over the years, you know, he'd pick up the old Gundam models because they were going like in the 70s and 80s, well, probably more the 80s and the 70s. But you know, I've got these Japanese kits that I put together, and I like the idea of the mech. I've just never really followed any of the shows other than, you know, like things like Battle of the Planets, which was what's that called?
Gatchaman, wasn't it?
Gatchaman. Yeah, Gatchaman. That's exactly what it is. Like, it's an Americanized version of it.
Because I believe Gatchaman was one of the first shows which was like the pilot inside the robot, because prior to that, it was sort of like you normally had like the guy with the controller on a wrist controller, so things like Giant Robot and stuff. And I think it was if I remember my history right, it was Go Nagai, who is also the same person who created like the likes of Violence Jack. These like really violent anime, who did a lot of like the revolutionary work within the field of sort of like giant mecha. But certainly giant mecha is a really great genre, but at the same time it's also one that you can look at stuff like Evangelion and it gets like really angsty and sort of weighed down in like family drama. And the same with like Gundam, the idea that you often like put these children into these giant war machines and then wonder why they have complete mental breakdowns when you fight on the battlefield. Which is obviously like one of the key themes of Evangelion. Which brings me on to the next thing I've watched, which I've watched the first two rebuilds of Evangelion. Evangelion 1.0, You Are Not Alone, and Evangelion 2, You Cannot Advance. Now, if you've not seen the original Evangelion, which is a 24-episode run, don't worry, because this is sort of like a reboot in many ways. This is by the same director as Shin Godzilla, and he's also done Shin Kamen Rider recently.
Shin Ultraman, yeah.
Yes, sorry,
Shin Ultraman. I guess it's... Yeah, this is something I've forgotten. I haven't watched yet, but yes.
Yeah.
But this is animated, is it?
This is animated. He's creating his own Shin universe.
Because Shin just means new in Japanese, I believe, right?
Yeah. But you may have seen that promo video of like Evangelion and Godzilla and Ultraman and Kamen Rider all sort of like running around together.
Right.
Which is sort of like a promo for this idea that he has of like his own multiverse where all these characters can exist in the same universe.
Gotcha.
So, which is the Shin universe. And the Evangelion 1.0 is essentially a rebuild of the original Evangelion series. But it has little sort of differences. The first 1.0 takes in the first block of episodes, which I believe is the first six. So when we had the original Evangelion, you could watch the series and deal with the controversial ending because the show kind of ran out of money. So the ending was very sort of weirdly animated. So they brought out the end of Evangelion as a way to like give it a proper wrap up. And this also gave fans an alternate ending, which was kind of like a downbeat ending compared to the upbeat ending of the original. And now with the rebuild series, it basically scraps everything and starts over again, because the series creator Anno, he wanted to like tell new stories within the Evangelion universe, but kind of when everything ends on like an apocalyptic note, you've kind of written yourself into a corner. So here he sort of like comes back and he's viewed it as like, this is my chance to do Evangelion, like the Gundam series, and like create a new sort of like franchise out of it. And this first one is the first six episodes, and it's as close to the original series as this series gets, really, as you basically get a retread of those six episodes. They change bits and pieces, they improve animation, and you get some new details here, but basically it's still the 14-year-old Shinji being forced into piloting this mecha while dealing with the detached relationship he has with his father, who's also the head of this paramilitary organization, Nerve, which is the organization who's set up to battle these giant monsters known as angels. Follow me so far?
Okay. Yes, I'm doing my best. Okay. Let's put it that way.
When we get on to Evangelion 2.0, this is where things really get interesting for this rebuild, as it veers away from what we had, what the first one did, and it starts telling new stories. We get new characters being introduced, and we also get some of the characters having their personalities retweaked and new sequences, and it really takes in an interesting direction, including a rather shocking ending, which leads me into number three, which I'm still in the process of watching, and on the next episode I'll be able to give you a bit of a recap on. But certainly, if you've seen the original Evangelion, I would certainly recommend checking this out. If you've never seen the original Evangelion, still check it out, because you can still watch these as they are and still thoroughly enjoy them. So that would save you watching 24 episodes or something, Stephen. You can just watch four films instead.
We'll see. No promises.
On the next episode, Evangelion 1-4.
That would be the way, wouldn't it, to force me to watch something, to bring one to the show.
That would be one way. It would also be a probably really long show to try and break down.
Yeah,
down the ins and outs of that one. As I said, everything else that I've seen it's all sort of been very sort of Western cinema based. You know, I finally went to see what the Barbie movie craze was about, and I'm sure something happened in that movie. I'm not sure what ideas were thrown at the screen, yeah, we'll just leave that one alone.
I'm obviously going to have to keep my powder dry due to my other podcast. I think of that.
I feel there are other things you could spend your time watching. But not possibly at the cinema at the minute, because I mean, it's either that or Oppenheimer, I think, are your only choices at the minute, so.
Yeah, I have seen both of them. I have opinions on both.
You could go and watch the Meg 2, which is, I found out, is produced by the same production company that gave us The Wandering Earth.
What film? Oh, Meg 2, yeah. Yes.
The Chinese investment company also gave us The Wandering Earth film, so.
Yeah, I mean, clearly, I mean, I watched The Meg fairly recently, probably in the last 6 months for the first time, and I mean, Chinese money was all over that, including a tacked on end, which it looks like Meg 2 sort of is more of the same, but even more. I will watch. I had a good time with the Meg, actually, when I shouldn't have done. And I don't care if it's over the top and ridiculous. I love a Jason Statham movie, even, and giant sharks just makes it even better.
Cool. But still, what have you been watching?
Okay, so this is going to be a pattern for the next few months. Basically, I'm going through all the DVDs that I've been importing or that I've picked up whilst in foreign countries, my Asian DVDs. I had new carpets fitted and I had to sort of get everything out of my living room back in again, and so lots of DVDs got thrown into a box while things were moved around. And so I'm basically working through my collection and sort of re-watching and sometimes first time watching stuff that I've picked up. I mean, I think you have an idea of how many bloody DVDs I have. So I'm trying to watch a couple of them every week. A lot of these are films that I watched, like basically over since about 98 onwards, so the last 25 years. And obviously when I was doing my blog, my Guelo Ramblings blog, I'd be watching like a film a night and stuff like that. So it's sort of revisiting things. So hopefully it'll give me a refresh when we get to our next top Asian films, and it reminds me of things. So there's a couple of movies that these are rewatches for me, but I won't have watched them for 15 years at least. So the first one I watched is a film called, these are both Hong Kong movies. So the first one is called Jiang Hu, directed by Wong Jing Po, who I think directed Revenge, a Love Story, which is another one that shall come up and rewatch at some point. So it is a triad drama, starring basically sort of two storylines. One of them is there's a sort of leader of the Hong Kong of a triad, Andy Lau. His girlfriend or wife has recently given birth, and he's considering, you know, leaving the game, getting out of the game, and moving to Canada and sort of basically going straight. And there's sort of a battle of wills or a discussion with his, I'm going to call it his right-hand man, played by Jackie Chung, a guy called Lefty, because he's only got one hand. The other one was removed. And so this is battle of wills. Meanwhile, there's two younger operatives, one played by Sean Yu and one played by Edison Chen, who are basically challenged with their first, you know, they're going to have, Sean Yu basically has been given the job of killing someone. And so we spend a night in the company of both of these pairs, and stuff happens. There's a twist at the end, which I won't ruin. It's got all the, you know, it's got, you know, it's got Andy Lau, it's got Sean Yu, it's got Eric Chang, it's got Chapman Toe, it's got Cara Hui, it's got Lam Suet, you know, it's got all the usual names. It's a 2004 film. It's really well made. It's only 85 minutes long. And when I say it's really well made, it's very beautiful to look at. There's some really cool visuals going on. I remember enjoying it the first time, probably because I like the twist. I'm wondering if I should give away this, but no, I'm not going to give away the twist. But it's a very 2004 Hong Kong crime thriller, just sort of really polished, lots of star power in it. Wouldn't necessarily recommend it. I think, you know, we'd probably go more Johnny Toe, get someone to watch Election instead. It's pretty good, pretty enjoyable. Quite glad I watched it again. The other one was a movie from 2007. Now, I know I've spoken about the Pang brothers before. I know very early show I brought the eye to the show, and I did try and bring Recycle, but we failed there, didn't we?
Had trouble sourcing it, didn't we, Sam?
Yeah. Now, I'm a huge fan of the Pang brothers, both together and when they do their solo works, or Oxide Pang and Danny Pang. And there is this period post I for about 6 or 7 years where they're just pumping out these movies that I really enjoy. So I know I talk a lot about Diary is one of my favourites, but sort of in the similar world, this is one called In Love with the Dead. Sean Yu again. he just was all over. He's going to be in a lot of these movies I rewatch because he was just in every bloody movie I think between about 2004 and 2008. So he plays this sort of he's a sort of a successful designer. His girlfriend, played by Steffi Tang, basically comes down with pancreatic cancer, and he chooses to basically sort of step back on his really successful career to care for her. He takes a much lower paid job, ends up, his boss though is a girl that they were both at school with, that Steffi Yang is basically sort of his childhood sweetheart, and a kind of sort of love triangle ensues. But being a Pang Brothers film, and this is specifically, this is, I'm just checking it, is Danny. So this is a Danny Pang movie. A bit like M. Night Shyamalan has to have a twist ending. A lot of their film, Danny's films and Oxide's films, get a bit like this. So it is like this sort of slow burn drama with a little bit of creepy girl ghost stuff sort of happening on the edges. And then film takes a sharp left turn into basically necrophilia.
Right.
You didn't see that coming, did you? Let's just say not everybody in the film has been alive the whole time, and it goes. I mean, again, it's not a long film. I'm pretty certain it's only about an hour, 97 minutes. I'd forgotten what a slow burn it was, but I knew what the twist was. But the twist happened, there was more going on in those last 10 minutes than I remembered. Again, I really, really enjoyed this. I think it might be quite a hard one to track down. Even with the success in the West of the Eye, I don't ever feel that a lot of them... I know Bangkok Dangerous both got remade and released as a Tartanation cinema, but so much of their stuff never came across until the sort of the C+ Detective stuff came out sort of about 10 years later. If you can get it though, yeah, films like this are just a lot of fun. I'm really glad. Yeah, the other thing I'm checking is, can I play it on my PS5? Are they region 3 discs and not region 3, which is more difficult for me to watch at the moment, because I don't have a region 3 DVD player easily to hand. It's packed away somewhere. So, yeah, I enjoy it. In Love of the Dead, I enjoy it a lot. I'm pretty certain I've probably already put it in one of our top Asian cinema films in the past. But it was nice to go back to it, but I had forgotten quite what a left turn it makes in the final act. a whiplash in tone, I think, is the way to describe it. So that's the two main things I've been watching. I will just cheat a bit, and I know I do this a lot. Like you said, I'll bring up a Western film as well. A friend at work actually put me onto this. It's a documentary called King Rocker. And the reason I bring it up is it sort of brought up a real black hole in my knowledge that I don't understand why I had it. So it's basically about a fella called Robert Lloyd, who's this guy that basically is the lead singer of a band called The Nightingales, which was sort of one of these post-punk bands that apparently, you know, if I say a John Peel kind of sponsored band, you know, you'll know who John Peel
is.
Yeah,
of course.
Elwood. And I love a lot of that music, but I had never heard of the Nightingales at all. And so this documentary, so it's fronted by Stuart Lee, the comedian Stuart Lee, who, and it's kind of like a love letter, not just to Robert Lloyd and this band, but also to sort of Birmingham, the city of Birmingham, and the way the city of Birmingham, which should appeal to you, I think. I think you've got some roots in Birmingham, haven't you? But the sort of the way that Birmingham sometimes rejects its own pop culture. It's and I was talking to the guy that sort of turned me onto the film. He's from the area, and he was sort of saying, yes, it's very much the case that they don't really celebrate same way like a city like Manchester or Liverpool go fucking on and on about their bands and their football clubs.
The only thing I can think of coming out of Birmingham is Ozzy Osbourne. You've got
Black Sabbath, UB40. I think we could probably name a few, right? But I mean, whatever you might think about UB40, they're probably one of the biggest bands to ever come out of Birmingham.
Oh my god, UB40, I view in the as feel like tossing in the same pile as like the whole British punk scene, and the fact that punk was an American invention, but don't you tell British punkers that, because they like to believe they have. And I mean, most of it's forgettable. I mean, yes, obviously the Clash have their moments and the Jam, but obviously like Sush and the Banshees is very dated. Sex Pistols were overrated and only lasted a year, so don't start talking about that. I think when it comes to punk music, I mean, it only really got interesting of like when you look into the 80s and that sort of revival scene, which obviously gave us the likes of Descendants and Rancid and Bad Religion and NoFX and those ones.
Yeah, okay, yeah, I see. We may have a difference of opinion here, but that's a different show. Anyway, one of the beautiful things about King Rocker is, and again, I never knew about this, but it draws an illusion. So apparently, back in the 70s or 80s, there was this thing where there was this is government-based arts project where every city was like given, like these art installations were put into these cities, and the city was able to purchase it if it wanted and then sort of make it part of it. And for some reason, there was this statue of King Kong that was made and installed just outside Birmingham New Street Station, right? And after 6 months, Birmingham City Council decided they didn't want it anymore. And, like, the only city to reject it. So, again, you see where it's going. There's this wonderful pop culture object that Birmingham just rejected. So the story about this statue and Stuart Lee trying to find where it is. And actually, it's been found. It's had some adventures, but it's been repaired, and it's now standing somewhere in Cumbria up near Penrith. But it draws this illusion between there's this guy that he never quite made it, yet the band is, it's a bit like, you know, like when they talk about They Might Be Giants or something like, or Pixies, and there's all these really successful bands. Yeah, I was really into the Pixies, I was really into They Might Be Giants, but they never really went outside of being cult. So it feels like the Nightingales are like that. And the music's fine, the guys are, but he's had minor success, he's had complete failure, he's had a stroke, he's recovered from it, but he's still playing today. And there's this charming Stuart Lee. I don't know if you're a fan of the comedian Stuart Lee. I mean, I think he's
90s alt generation, I believe, is that right?
Liam McConey, yeah, they sort of BBC sort of left wing comedian, but actually he's a lot cleverer than that. He's not somebody I automatically go to, but I know he's got his fans. Anyway, he's charming in this, and the relationship he builds up with Robert Lloyd is just fantastic. It's just like two middle-aged blokes laughing over every joke. But it's a really... I'm spending far too long phrasing this in my film club, but it's really fucking charming. Unfortunately, it didn't get a cinema release and was released on Sky Arts. I was able to, basically, there's like a little hardback DVD and CD which acts as a best of the Nightingales, but also it's got the film on it as well. But it's really nice, and they've got cracking commentary. The music's good. There's a load of talking heads, sort of famous people from the time. My favourite bit I'll just mention. So Robin Asquith, who I think that's his name, the guy that was in all Confessions films in the 70s, right? The smutty Adventures of a Window.
Yeah, he was also in Queen Kong as well.
He is in Queen Kong, because obviously that's the link, right, with it. And Robert Lloyd has got this story, and obviously with all these bands, with these dedicated fan base, there's lots of apocrypha and little stories. And there's a story about where he said he once went to this gym in Birmingham, and he has shared a shower with Robin Asquith, and Robin Asquith sort of, he comes on, he's getting on a bit now, talking. He says, I categorically deny I've ever shared a shower with Robert Lloyd, and then proceeds for 5 minutes to list all the famous people he has had showers with. A lot of them are in his smutty films, because a lot of these films had quite famous actors and actresses in it, and then a lot of them are just people that he has had showers with. And it's that'll give you the sort of the tone of it. It's kind of irreverent, but it's also quite charming. If you're in or around Birmingham, you probably know about this band, but if you can dig it out, I think you'd really enjoy it. I mean, we do talk a lot about music, don't we, outside the show, and I think you might find it quite charming, even if you're not aware of the band. That's it for me.
Mm. I remembered another one from Birmingham.
Yeah,
the Freshies, fronted by Frank Sidebottom. They used to hang around Birmingham a lot.
There's another quite interesting film
over by Timberley. Well,
Frank Sidebottom. That's Manchester, though, isn't it? Frank Sidebottom. What's his name? Chris
Spivey.
Something else.
Chris Spivey. Yeah.
Chris Spivey. Yeah. That's a Manchester thing. But I'm sure he did. I'm sure.
I've got a number of pubs where, as well. With Frank Sidebottom in front of, so I know where he's hung out. So.
Oh, bless him. Bless him. Long. Much missed. You know,
the man who gave us I'm in Love with the Girl at the Manchester Virgin Megastore checkout desk.
Well, a guy that managed to have an alternative comedy, a music, and a children's TV career all at the same time, whilst wearing a giant paper mache head.
Yeah. He also had Little Frank, who someone stole the head off.
Yeah. And quite an interesting little movie with, what's his name? The Irish actor.
Oh, yeah. You've got Being Frank, which is a documentary about the man, and then you've got the indie film Frank, which has got Old Magneto.
Yeah, I can't remember. I want to call him Ian Fassbender, but that's not quite right. Michael Fassbender. That's right. And based because John Ronson was in that band, the famous journalist and conspiracy debunker.
Oh, the man who wrote The Men Who Stare at Goats.
He did. Yeah, he was in the Frank Sidebottom band.
Cool.
And the film Frank is based on his book about it. There we go. Right. Well, everybody, this really is the Asian Cinema Film Club. Oh, dear.
Enjoy this upbeat nature, because you probably ain't going to be in the second half of the show. So, yeah, unless you want to regale us with any more of your musical finds, Stephen, we'll get...
No, that's it.
Yes, I mean, the only documentary I saw this week was the Pez Outlaw, about the guy who imported Pez from Europe into America.
That actually sounds quite interesting as well. And that's not the sort of thing I'd enjoy.
And we had, obviously in Western cinema, we had a couple of sad deaths. We had the death of William Friedkin. William Friedkin?
Indeed. William Friedkin.
Yes.
Exorcist. Sorcerer. Which came out, you timed that, didn't you?
2 weeks after the return of MBDS talking about Sorcerer, he died. So
yeah,
that was great.
French Connection. Yep.
And Pee Wee Herman died, whose name I can't remember now.
Who died, sorry?
Paul Rubens passed on.
Oh, Paul Rubin. Pee Wee.
Yeah.
Pee Wee Herman.
And it dawned on me while watching Pee-wee's Big Holiday that the world of Pee-wee and the world of Blue Velvet might exist in the same world.
Oh, really? There's a shared universe concept.
Somewhere in the Pee-wee world, you've got Dennis Hopper saying that a love letter for me is a bullet to the fucking brain. Going on about...
I always imagined that they lived in the Batman universe.
Really?
Yeah. Well, because Pee-wee's Big Adventure and the Michael Keaton first Batman film, obviously Tim Burton is the director of them both. And just in my head, all Tim Burton's films happen in the same universe.
No, the Burtonverse. No, it's because obviously Pee-wee embodies that postcard version of Americana, the same way as... David Lynch's Blue Velvet does. Obviously, Blue Velvet's about the seedy underbelly. So it's sort of like, you know, what's happening under the underbelly of Pee Wee World. So,
But back. I mean, yeah, I was quite shocked to see that he died. I hadn't realised he was that old. And to be honest with you, in my head, he'd never got past the being caught in a sex cinema, tossing himself off. But
he'd had a
huge career after that I was totally unaware of.
He was in Night Before Christmas. He was the voice of Locke, who's the devil.
Yeah. And no. It's very sad passings.
Yes.
Indeed.
But it's time to follow the projector for tonight's feature presentation, which is 1998's Whispering Corridors. So, Whispering Corridors is a Korean horror film. It was also released during the initial boom of film production from South Korea following the liberalization of censorship in the aftermath and the end of the country's military dictatorship, which also reflects in the film, which serves as not only a ghost story but also a social commentary on often terrorism and conformity within the educational system. The film itself is set in an all-girls school, which has started suffering from a series of rumours following the death of one of the teachers. At the same time, the rumour being that there is a ghost that is out for revenge in the school, and it's down to a number of the pupils to try and solve the mystery before they suffer the curse of the ghost. This was a bit of a blind spot for myself, as I remember it coming out in the midst of the Tartan Asia extreme boom, but it's one I never actually got around to watching. And for all this time I was thinking it was a Japanese film, but it's actually a Korean film. So, and it's one that's been followed by 5 sequels, all of them standalone films. But Stephen, this was your pick. What was it about Whispering Corridors that made you want to watch it?
Well, if I'd known you'd never seen it before, that would have made it a good reason in of itself. But no, so to my mind, I mean, you've already mentioned it. It is very much part of that horror boom, that Asian cinema boom we saw in or around the turn of the millennium. We've done a whole bloody extra podcast on Battle Royale. We've talked about Ring. I think I bought Ring, didn't I, back a few weeks ago, thinking about it. I'm obviously sort of trying to redo that. But Whispering Corridors was really the first Korean part of that. It was part of the K-wave. It was a part of the J-horror wave. It was one of the... It got not only have... I think the first four in the... Or the first three got Tartan Asian cinema... Tartan releases. And then... all packaged up with a 4-in-1 called Quartet, which is what I've got. But I thought it was interesting because it was the first. I wanted to go back and have a look at it. I mean, it's 25 years old. A host of imitators. You know, yes, like you say, there are 5 sort of sequels or 5 films in the series, but the only thing they've got in common is that they're all basically set in all girls schools. I hadn't really remembered this film. I've always considered it the most standard. Possibly was I having a negative feeling about it because there's so many imitators, and let's be fair, maybe it was doing things before everywhere else. So yeah, I wanted to rewatch it to reappraise it because it's 25 years old, and it was very much on that part of that wave of cinema, Audition, you know, all those films we keep talking about. We should really talk about Whispering Corridors in the same voice, but because you'd never seen it, I guess we've never really brought it up before. Whether or not I did enjoy it more than the second time, or well, it's not the second time I've seen it, but you know, this more recent view, we'll get to as we talk about the film, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, I should say right off the bat, when it comes to horror films, I'm not a fan of ghost stories at all. I think the weaker end of the genre, the same way with vampire movies. And I think the only way to really sort of grab my attention is to do something fun and unique with vampires. So it would be to do something like, you know, Near Dark, Freddy Days and Night, Lost Boys. anything involving like the more traditional sort of setup of like that felt more closer to Dracula, so, you know, like drafty castles and costume drama, just had no interest in myself. And I've always found with like ghost stories that they always were like sort of a lot of frills and not a lot of fret, unless we like look to the sort of like the likes of Toby Hooper's Poltergeist in that particular series, which sort of gave us a much more sort of violent spirit to work with. So the idea of spooky goings on an old girl school didn't really sort of grab me, and it's probably the reason that I didn't really check this one out. But as we said already, I mean, there's other things happening within this film. I mean, starting with the homeroom teacher, Mrs. Park, who's nicknamed Old Fox, who has a habit of circling around years in the students' yearbooks, and she's got a feeling that one of the students isn't who they say they are. But at the same time, she finds out only soon enough for her to find herself being noosed. And it's the next day that three of the senior students, the talented and suspicious artist Lim Ji O, the timid outsider Yoon Jae Yi, and the sullen and unpopular Kim Jung Suk, discover the teacher hung up. What would you say? It's not the rafters, really. It's almost like a walkway, isn't it?
It's like from a tree or something, isn't it? But you're right, I think it is a walkway. Yeah, so there's this weird opening sequence, which is edited really bizarrely. And
it feels like you're coming in the middle of something as well, doesn't it?
It does. Yeah, in media res, as they say. But yes, she phones somebody and talks about this student. Yeah, there's something about it. But then suddenly she's hanging from a tree, and then these three of these girls in this class have come in early. They seem to have like monitor duty or something, which seems to involve them having to do sort of clean the place up and do some sort of preschool sort of housekeeping that they have to do. They come across her body, but it is sort of this freeze frames that it's quite interestingly directed, but I did find it hard initially, and then the problem I have with all the Whispering Corridors films is that it's really hard to tell everyone apart because they're all wearing the same clothes because it's school uniform, isn't it? So I had that struggle as well. I like ghost stories, so we're already coming from a sort of slightly different a different place. I do like a creepy ghost story. And believe you me, you know, there are a lot of them in Asian, especially South Korean and Japanese cinema. And when we talked about things like Ring is kind of a ghost story, isn't it? In a way, it's just got this sort of science bit bolted on the side. But yeah, this is a real sort of this ghostly goings on, creepy stuff going on, and I like that. I like a Christmas ghost story and things like that. So this thing already was going to appeal to me. There are other Korean ghost stories that I prefer, but it starts off, and there's a lot of stuff that you have to take on, and I think it is quite hard to get into to start with. But then eventually you get to meet everybody. Everybody's quite well delineated. Maybe some people are a little one note in their characterizations, but at least you can start telling them apart, because it is really hard when they all wear the same uniform and you've got to tell them apart from their hairstyles, which isn't always obvious, because as I've said before, I really struggle to hear names in the Korean language and trying to assign the names to people I found hard. But then, of course, actually most of the horror in this movie isn't about ghosts at all. It's about that fucking awful teacher, Mr. O.
Oh yeah, the teacher who has the nickname of Mad Dog, because that's always what you think of, like being who you're going to bring in to teach you the youth of tomorrow. We're gonna have some guy called Mad Dog who's got a love of corporal punishment, as we see really early on. He has this class doing all sorts of bizarre sort of like stress training where they have to like hold themselves in various positions, and he's
get on your desk and hold your arms up.
Yeah,
which is a classic. I've seen that in so many Korean films. I'm not sure we saw it in the classic, but in others, things like Friends. there's a whole genre of movies set in high schools, and yeah, I mean, as you rightly said at the beginning, this film is a critique of the sort of the South Korean education system at the time. It's a critique of South Korean culture, full stop, at the time, which I think is quite nice when a horror movie's doing that. But yeah, and he's not just punishing them like that, and he walks around with a stick, doesn't he, that he pokes and hits them with. He fucking sexually abuses one of them. We don't see anything other than creepy acts around her, but whispering in her ear and touching her inappropriately. But this guy is fucking gross, and he's worse than any ghost in this movie.
Yeah, I mean, the horror genre has always been synonymous with, like, reflecting social sort of queries of the time, really, hasn't it? So it's always reflected what is going on in society. We've seen this being reflected through the horror genre. So I think the fact that this film is making this comment on the authoritarian nature of the education system and putting it against the backdrop of this ghost story. I think when it comes to the ghost story, though, it's so timid. It's when we look at, obviously, like the J horror at the time, and we look at things such as like Ring and Dark Water, there's so much atmosphere and styling to those films. And here we just have an old girls' school where occasionally one of the cast will be bumped off. So it's much more in tune with like a slasher than it is an actual ghost story for myself.
Yeah, no, I'd absolutely agree. And if we watch any of the other Whispering Corridors films, none of the others are quite like this. I mean, the second movie is this lesbian melodrama, which is really quite a different feel. The third movie has kind of a witchcrafty feel to it. The fourth one is basically you're following the ghost around. I love the fourth one, Voice. I think Voice is my favourite. The fifth one is concerned with suicides. I don't know what the sixth one is. I haven't seen the sixth one. It's a fairly recent invention. But they're all very different. I did feel this one, you know, when it was doing the social stuff, I thought it was really interesting. And again, you've got to remember, you know, how early to the game it was. So, you know, sometimes when you think, oh, I've seen 100 of these films like this, this was one of the first. And it really was. You know, this was a real, I'm just looking on the Wikipedia page, but it was really a surprise success locally in Korea. Although they have a history of horror and ghost stories. Oh, always has a history of sort of the ghost story thing. And it did come across, as we say, it was one of the sort of first things to break internationally. But I agree with you. The ghosty stuff in this is pretty minor. There are a couple of people, well, some people die, don't they, basically. And then there is this mystery about one of the, what's it called, one of the students. It's a bit of red herring, because one of them is, she's like the daughter of a shaman, isn't she? And so she's bullied a bit for not being modern and being a shaman. But there might be, you know, there's this mystery, which isn't very well put out, but basically one of the girls is maybe a ghost. And one of the teachers thinks it's like a reincarnation of somebody that she was at school with 6 years previously or 9 years previously. I can never remember. But yeah, as a creepy, tingly, oh my gosh, what's going on, scarefest, I don't think it's particularly successful.
No, I didn't think that, as I said, I didn't think that this really, it really sort of resonated with myself. I mean, the fact that this film is as long as it is, it's 105 minutes, so that's like a good hour and 40 minutes of your time that you're going to be giving up to this film. And yeah, it's not, it doesn't have the quickest sort of pacing to it, and yes, it does fun things with freeze frame, but also this is a film shot on the sort of film stock that even like TV soap operas would be embarrassed to be using. I don't know if it's just the copy I had, but it was as fuzzy as the copy of Evil Dead Trap I had.
I found a copy online that was an HD in 1080p, and it looks all right, but it does look like a TV movie.
And
we get very used to films from Korea, especially maybe not quite this, but sort of post 2000, they look fucking amazing. And you know, usually the production quality was what Japanese movies all look like they were shot on TV from this era. But these films, it seems to be shot in a more of a TV aspect ratio rather than full widescreen. I don't know if you felt that as well. You said interesting things, I think, with freeze frame. I thought it was a bit interesting. Let me try and say this correctly. For some reason, I think The Guardian or The Independent, did the 10 best Korean movies, right? And it was about the time of Parasite came out. So, you know, Korean movies at their apex. And it lists all the usuals, of the sort of modern Korean movies. Old Boy, Parasite. Interestingly, Mother was on there as well.
Oh, Mother made it.
Film we've talked about. Yeah. But the only horror movie I think on there was Whispering Corridors. And I did think that was odd. That was when I was sort of doing my research for the show. But it's on there for the one reason, which is that one shot, which I do think is the memorable shot of the movie, is sort of towards the end where the girl who is finally exposed as being the ghost kind of stop motions her way up a corridor towards you. So you point of view it, and then she sort of peers in the distance, and then she comes up in just with jumping. That is quite a spectacular shot. But that's the reason he put it in the top 10 Korean films of modern Korean films of all time. And I'm thinking, mate, this is that's a good shot. It's not, doesn't make this a great film. I think it's absolutely fine, right? I don't hate it. I didn't feel like wasting my time, but it isn't. The other films in this series are so much better than this. It just reaffirmed what I had thought, is that this is, although it got there first, it's a fairly routine Asian ghost girl story. And if we still did the same format where, you remember when we used to talk about other films you could pair with it, I could probably name 3 or 4 other movies with a similar sort of storyline that are a million times better than this.
Yeah, the thing I fear is that if you anything you named with it would be more recommendation of what to watch instead of this.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I'm thinking of something like Dead Friend, which is another movie I fucking love, which has got a sort of similar kind of idea. It ticks all those same boxes about bullying and the discipline involved in going to school, though it's not an all girls school. And that, I'll hold my fire on that, because I think Dead Friend's a film, because I think that got a UK release as well. But that's definitely a movie I'll bring to the show at some point, because that's one slightly different take on the ghost movie. I struggled keeping some of the characters straight. I honestly did. I couldn't remember who was who and why that person was that. And there's a fourth student, so young, you know, the one who's smoking down in the place where the art lessons happen.
Oh yes.
And I mean, she also gets murdered, doesn't she? But and she's actually part of the sting in the final scene. I thought, where does she come from? Who is she? Is she that other girl? I find it hard to keep them straight, because only two of them are given real character traits. Obviously, there's the shaman girl, who I think is our kind of lead, isn't she?
Yeah, I mean, she's basically the traditional sort of psychic schoolgirl. Here, this basically they get these visions, which is then transferring into art, which is then upsetting Mad Dog, who smashes it up, which then connects her to Yusiok's character, the art teacher, who's secretly smoking in the art room. It's there's a lot of these sort of things going on. I just struggle to really get into this film, even like on just the basic sort of level of it just being like a drama, never mind the actual ghost story here. It just really failed to engage me in the way I was hoping, which is kind of a shame, especially when you think, oh, I've got another 5 of these to go. It hardly has me rushing out to see what else happens in this series.
They are very, very different movies. Obviously, we haven't even talked about there's a new teacher, a new young teacher, Miss Her, who, like I say, is connected to the mystery, and she's our other lead, and she, you know, she suffers a bit because she's a female teacher, and it's a very patriarchal world. And there's bits of that going on, but it just doesn't really commit to a lot of it, other than the Mr. O and his sadistic ways. I didn't even feel Old Fox was particularly that bad a person, really.
I think he's just more sleazy than anything else, to be honest. Old Fox is the female teacher. Yeah, I mean, she did.
Yeah.
I don't think it really came across that she deserved to be hung from the rafters, but the only thing that sort of like has going for her that sort of like that you get the idea of her being the sort of like strict disciplinarian is the fact that she is dressed and made to look like every other strict disciplinarian female character we've seen before. You know, that sort of like, I'm trying to think, it's almost like a librarian, isn't it? So like a strict librarian look.
She's got that sort of spinstery librarian teacherly look. Yeah. Glasses, very pull back hair, very, very smartly dressed, but we barely meet her. We meet her a couple of times in flashbacks as well, but she doesn't strike me as any worse than any of the other standard teachers. I mean, some of them are just fucking lazy, and some of them are, you know, and it's being run again. It's a commentary on society at the time, and we've seen that done more interestingly, even in films that maybe you didn't like, things like Peppermint Candy, which is a bit more obvious in what it's showing, because it's actually showing real events. But I've seen it in films like Friend, whereas this is it's there. I think it's fine. I didn't mind watching it. I'm a bit sad you didn't get into it. I don't know whether I'd recommend that you moved on to the others. The second film is really interesting, and there are multiple cuts of it, and if you want to watch like one of the first queer dramas that's also a ghost story in Korean cinema, I'd recommend it. But it's very interesting. I'll bring it to the show one day, I'm sure we'll get through them all. I'm not going to just say let's do Whispering Corridors 2, my next choice, and so on, don't worry. But yeah, I think we just have to respect it for where it stands in the history of Korean cinema, right? It was one of the first breakthrough films. The other one alongside this, I think, is called Into the Mirror, which has got Choi In-sik in it, who's in Old Boy, which was remade, with Kiefer Sutherland, which I think was one of the first Korean films, you know, like when American cinema kept remaking stuff. I think Mirror... maybe it's called Into the Mirror. It's like
Mirrors.
It's Mirrors.
Yeah, Mirrors was the one that remade with
Kiefer Sutherland, isn't it?
Yeah, because it was remade by Alexandra Aja, who's had a string of fun remakes. He did Piranha 3D, and he was also responsible for. I just remember this right now. He did Hills of Eyes remake as well, and he did Switchblade Romance. I remember it came out of the French Extreme. Yeah, the Switchblade Romance, which is High Tension, in the States. But yeah, Mirrors was another odd one.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just looking. So Into the Mirror actually is 5 years after this, but they came over very similar time with the Tartan thing. So it may have been that it wasn't the first one to make it across. I'm having having strange memories, but you know, we're at that age now where things happened that long ago. I can't try and get memories in order, but yeah, it's there's a few films like this. Cello and Yoga and The Red Shoes. That's another one. So all from this kind of era. And then you look at, you've mentioned it already, and then you look at something like Dark Water from Japan. It just pisses all over these. Because that's a ghost story, but it's just it's literally dripping with atmosphere. Another film we must talk about sometime.
Yeah, I mean, Dark Water is on, I think it's probably going to appear around Halloween. As I said, we've talked about, we definitely talked about doing it as an episode. So I would imagine that's going to be on the horizon. You have got obviously any recommendations for films that we should be checking out over the Halloween season, please do let us know, as we are going to be doing the 30 days of Asian horror this year for our annual 30 days of something. We've obviously done the Takashi Miike month, we did Anthony Wong month, and this time we're going to be doing genre, and the genre being horror. So we obviously appreciate any recommendations.
Oh, and obviously, as always, when Elwood says we, he means he.
Yeah, we watched it. Stephen May was like coming at the end to put his name on things, you know, like Matt Damon on the Good Will Hunting script.
Yeah, that's me. I'm the Matt Damon of the show. Yeah, I'll watch about six of them, and I'll have seen another six of them in the past, and I'll be able to pass comment. But you're the man who's doing the hard labour of making.
I've got a few
31 films.
I've got a few ideas of things that I want to include. A lot of blind spot stuff in there. The stuff that I really hope that you do watch. So, because it'd be fun to talk about. So we got some. We got a lot of old school anime in there. We've got some splatter in there. So yeah, it's gonna be a fun month. So, but cool. Yeah, I can't say that Whispering Corridors will be making a repeat appearance in that month.
Oh, unless you really need one. Yeah, well, I'm a little bit sad because I don't think there's anything fundamentally wrong with it. But if ghost stories aren't your cup of tea. And it hasn't got, like you say, it hasn't got a huge scary hook in it. I don't think.
That's the aisle.
That's the aisle. Oh, yeah, that is the aisle. Yeah. Very good. Another movie from that era. I don't think it's one, you know, if you turn down the lights and you watch it late at night, that you're going to get particularly scared by anything. So I think that's a fair comment. So I think we can agree it's important rather than important, if you know what I mean.
Well, Ben over at the Third Window Films podcast is also a fan, so you two can hang out.
He is a fan.
Yes, he gave it 4 stars.
Okay.
So you two can hang out and share your love of Whispering Corridors. Why?
I think I've quite clearly said I think it's an adequate film and the weakest of the series. So don't tar me with 4 stars. I think it's a solid 2.5 out of 5, and it's got some interesting stuff going on. I will defend Whispering Corridors 4 to the death, though, if we ever get to do that. That's my favourite by far.
So yeah, that brings it into tonight's episode. Thank you as always for listening. If you haven't done already, please do hit the like and subscribe button wherever you happen to listen to us. Leave us a review, as it helps raise the profile of the show. It is obviously my turn to pick next week, and I had a couple of ideas of which direction we could go. As much like when it came to picking this one, you had your art house, or you wanted to do something spooky, wasn't it? So. And for myself, as I said, I was bouncing around another anime title we could have done, another title, and it basically just came down to which I think had been on Netflix the longest and which I could see disappearing rather sharpish. So on the next episode, we're going to be looking at another Zhang Yimou film. We're going to be looking at 2018 Shadow.
Okay, I haven't seen Shadow. It's the one with sort of the black and white, isn't it? I've actually got it. I own it.
Yeah, the colour palette on this one's black and grey.
Yeah. We don't do enough Chinese cinema. Have we done a Zhang Yimou film?
We have. We did Curse of the Golden Flower.
We did, didn't we? That's
this was inspired,
right,
really, by Heather Baxendale. She had recently, she posted that she had won the Lam Movie of the Month contest with Hero. And as I said, we're talking for her, and I said, you know, it's a shame nobody ever talks about Curse of the Golden Flower and Shadow, the old sort of thing that ended with House of the Flying Daggers. Which, for my money, was very stunningly short, but very overlong. And Shadow seemed to sort of like slip past many people's sort of radar the same way that Curse of the Golden Flower had. But seeing as it is on Netflix, I'll save myself a week of having to track things down, and we can check it out on there. So, yep, next episode we'll be talking about Shadow from 2018.
Yeah, no, I'm looking forward to that. It's not such a blind spot. It's just a film I haven't got around to watching. Another Wu Chef for us. See if we like it more than. Well, I know you've seen it before, but I'll see if it's as good as The Assassin. I'm joking.
So that's all to come up in our next episode. But until then, thank you for listening. Thanks to my co-host, Steven.
Pleasure as always.
And join us next time for Shadow. Hey! 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 Kinono-no-ko-hi-wa-wasurete.
This podcast is a proud member of the Lamb Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.